Okie dokie. So the first thing to announce is there's no class next week. It's Rosh Hashanah, and at the new school, Rosh Hashanah is an official holiday. So there are no classes after 4 o'clock next Wednesday or on Thursday. Hi. Bibliography and texts. First, I guess a word about translations. Meredith and Bernard are both very readable, but lacking in accuracy, but both of them read extremely well, especially the old Bernard. She's wonderful. It's quite beautiful. Weyer and Eric Matthews, the Cambridge, is easily the most accurate. In fact, it imitates the German syntax. Now, as Robert Wicks has nicely put it, it is so accurate that when Kant is vague, so is it. So it's absolutely useless, I think. But it's literal. Easily the best, and the one we'll be using is the Pluhar. This one. And in class, and when you're writing your essays, please refer to the paragraph number in the text and the Academy pagination, which is in the margin. So it's the marginal paginations that we'll be using. And the reason for that is that allows people who are using the German or different editions to cross-check. The title of the work, I'm going to need just that much space. I'm right there from the board. Title in German is The Critique of Judgment Power. Or Croft is two words. The reason Urteil is the German word for judgment, and Croft is the name for power or force. And if you're a Hertelian, Hertelian just goes crazy with the word Urteil. Because that can be broken down into original separation. And therefore, that very thought is the foundation of all Hertelian's thought. And that's the last I'll say about Hertelian. So I will talk about it as the critique of judgment, but technically it is the critique of judgment power. Okay. Commentaries. We're spending the whole semester on a book that's not very long, and indeed we're spending most of the semester on really just the first 230-odd pages. So the mysteries, and it's not, unlike The Critique of Pure Reason, the writing is not really mysterious here. What's mysterious is what Kant's saying, and therefore you really do want to engage with at least two or three different critical commentaries to get some sense of the debates. And I'll explain why there are debates about it, but really to as graduate students, you should be digging into the secondary literature. For me, the although dull, really, really dull. The most reliable commentary is Allison. Allison is a man who does make a virtue of dullness. He is always dull in any circumstances. Alive, on paper, doesn't matter if he's equally dull. But he is a fine, fine, fine scholar. And I'll be often building arguments off of and against Allison. I have put on the bibliography a fair number of other things that will give you, I hope, lots of ideas. Allison's own text contains itself lots of interesting bibliographical suggestions, and the new introductory text by Wenzel, An Introduction to Kant's Aesthetics, has an annotated bibliography in the sense that every section he talks about, he then annotates it with suggestions about the debates in the secondary literature, which is immensely helpful. So that's a kind of useful device. Two further things. How many here have already taken courses on the Critique of Pure Reason? On the Critique of Kant's Moral Philosophy? Okay, you're all in a bit of shtuck. Because you cannot understand, and I'm going to spend a lot of today talking about the first critique and the second critique, but you really are going to need to be able to think through Kant's other critical ideas. And what I suggest, if you have not yet studied well either the first critique or Kant's Moral Philosophy, is that you get a hold of Paul Guire's book, Kant, and read it. And that's what you should be doing over the next 2 weeks that we're not meeting. Do that. Otherwise, you will not be able to appreciate the third critique. The third critique, for reasons I'll explain, really enters into an elaborate discussion with Kant's other texts. You should also, of course, if you're doing that, get a hold of at least the Critique of Pure Reason itself. I will occasionally be referring to it as the semester goes on. My preference, again, is for the older translation by Ken Smith. And you should get a hold of either the Second Critique or the Foundations of the Metaphysics and Morals, but one of Kant's basic moral philosophy texts. Okay, but you need to familiarize yourself with it. I'm going to spend a good hour and a half today talking about those other critiques and laying out what they're about, but you do need to kind of sit down and work those ideas through. Maybe that will scare some of you away. The next thing to be said is next time we meet, we're beginning at the deep, 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 deep end of the text. Namely with the first introduction, which was unpublished in Kant's lifetime. And for me, the first introduction is, it comes as an appendix in Pluart, and it raises all sorts of problems about the nature of reflective judgment. So you will also want to track down in the secondary literature, Gabe's going to put on reserve all the standard commentaries on the third critique tomorrow.
Yeah.
Grab them off the shelves quick and so they get hold of them. And, you know, you to read about this idea of reflective judgment. It's a complex, interesting idea, but the whole text really, for me, turns on this problem of reflective judgment. One last comment then about of an introductory nature is that if you are, as one might, after a week or two thinking, oh my God, what have I done? Why am I here and what's this all about? There really are now some terrific introductory texts to the third critique. Two very, very new ones are actually both very good. One by Robert Wicks, which is in the Routledge Guide series, and the one I've already mentioned by Wenzel, which is published, I think, by Blackwell. Okay, so and you know, Kant's not an easy read. Get any help you can. Of course, if you have real troubles, come and talk to me. If you are feeling shy and you need some help figuring out Kant's system, what he means by transcendental, all these kind of questions, I have a teaching assistant, Gabe Gottlieb. Gabe, email Gabe. Gabe, you want to give him your email?
Yeah.
Want to write it? And if you're too shy to come and talk to me during my office hours, have a chat with Gabe. He knows all about this crazy German idealist stuff. He's so crazy, he's doing his thesis on Fichte. Great. Anything else about mechanical things? Okay, let's do some philosophy. The other thing I should say is, for those who are new to all of this, the way I do things is, what we'll do is I'll talk for an hour and a quarter, and then we'll break for 15 minutes for a break for your drug of choice, and then we will come back and we will go on until they throw us out of the building, which is usually around 10:30, quarter of 11. Okay. So if you have to make a train, what can I tell you? Any questions about anything before I begin diving in? I think one further thing before I begin. What I don't tend to do, and I won't be doing in this course, is I am embarrassed by the notion of self-referencing. I've written this, I've written that. So I've written about Kant in two places, in a book called The Fate of Art, and in a book that's not on your bibliography, called Against Voluptuous Bodies. And both of them just have chapters on the third critique. And my strategy for thinking about modern art in relationship to Kant, it's even weirder. In the forthcoming Brooklyn Rail, what am I thinking? The forthcoming British Rail, we'll take a train and just go home. In the Brooklyn Rail, they're going to have an endless interview with me, which online is about 7,000 words. So you can figure out what I think about art. Okay, that's it for me. I guess by now everybody knows that the very first thing that philosophy does in order to become philosophy, to reveal what philosophy truly is to throw out the poets from the Republic. Philosophy is defined, I would even say philosophy is constituted, by its repudiation of art. It's emptying art of any potential significance, it's silencing of art, and then in a second gesture, that is, once philosophy has utterly emptied art of any potential content. So we know that Plato says, first of all, what artists do, they're copies of copies of copies. So, you know, they're ephemeral, they're mere appearances, they are illusions, they have nothing useful to teach us about the world, and worst of all, right, they stir up irrational emotions. So after he's totally, you know, said that art is just an empty and a bad thing, you wouldn't think it'd be both, but both an empty and a bad thing, he then, in a second gesture, appropriates to philosophy itself the remnant. That is, of course, there's lots of aesthetics in Plato. Beauty is nothing else but the introduction to the good. So what Plato does is make this empty remnant this dangerous thing called art and make it fully rational and safe. Nietzsche calls this second gesture aesthetic Socratism. The philosopher, having so identified reason with beauty that nothing could be beautiful that is not rational. These two gestures, which Danto calls ephemeralization, make art worthless, and takeover, and then say, and anyway, it's all in philosophy anyway, right? So beauty's no good, and whatever's good about it, it's in philosophy, so you don't have to worry. That double gesture is, I think, definitive of what philosophy often takes itself to be. And it's because of this that the original debate about art and aesthetics in relation to philosophy took place over the question of tragedy. Let me put the point another way. Philosophy becomes philosophy precisely by its defeating art, beauty, aesthetics, by showing the world that although philosophy is not itself science, that is, useful knowledge, still, thank God, it's not art. Right? So, I mean, everyone has to be better than somebody. Philosophy is worse than science, but at least it's better than art. Art's the guy that philosophy points to in order to reassure itself of its own worthwhileness and its validity. In this respect, and I take this to be worrying and serious, the dignity of philosophy, and this is, I think, definitive of analytic philosophy, the dignity of philosophy is predicated on the dismissal, silencing, and repudiation of art. Philosophy is defined, like we are, by exclusions. Art's the thing it has to exclude. And this, of course, has consequences for the very nature of philosophy itself. Since once the whole domain of the arts are eluded, then the bones of reality that philosophy is left to pick over are just that, dead remnants. I take the idea that these remnants are dead to be literal. That philosophy has only ever talked about dead things. Think of it this way. Try to think about things that philosophers that are important, indeed central human activities that philosophy rarely, if ever, talks about. What are they? Those are the sort of things that philosophy doesn't talk much about that are absolutely central to human life. Yeah? Sex. Right there in the middle. Yeah? What else? Food. Eating. Yep. Because no one eats in philosophy, right? You know, it's that. Well, there's that famous, you know, quip by Michel Ar. You know, does I never take a piss? Right? Ruby,
are you talking about things that serve to further the activity of corporeality?
I'm simply asking you, what are fundamental human activities that philosophy is strangely silent about? So far, I'm not making a judgment about how to generalize that. Yeah?
Music.
Music. Sure.
Marx aside, how about money?
money. Good. I like money. I'm going to put money on this side.
It's right up there with sex. That's all you need in life, right?
You can think what you want about that. I'll say why. What else? Yeah, yeah, yeah. All right. Does anyone know who wrote A Philosophy of Money?
No.
Simon. Yeah, yeah. It is a great philosophy of money. Yeah.
So,
children. Philosophers hate children. Philosophers. Yes, they hate women. They hate children even more. Right? What else? This is great.
Aging.
Yep. Yep. Drugs.
I can go with that.
Sport?
Sport. Good. Play.
So sport looks widely. Play.
Yep.
Sleep.
Sleep.
Dance.
Dance.
Just read a wonderful book by a former student of mine, Susan Cozell, which is called Closer.
It's coming out on MIT Press, and it's about performance. She's a dancer, but performances in relationship to technology. It's an absolutely... And phenomenology. It's phenomenology, the relation of dance to technology. And describes all these things that Susan has done over the years. It's remarkable. Yeah, anything else?
Dreams.
Dreams. By Nancy Bauer on the Fight Club, which is a great, great essay. Forthcoming. Anything else?
Laughing.
Laughing. Oh, laughing and crying. I love that.
Laughing and crying. There's a wonderful book. Does anyone know by whom?
Not on laughing and crying. Laughing.
Plessner.
Yes. Helmuth Plessner has written a great, great book on laughing and crying. Okay, well, we can do dance, music, painting, poetry, etc. The arts here. So, how, asking Ruby's question, how do we want to generalize what it is that philosophy ignores?
Experience.
Certainly it's experience, yeah?
Things that relate to our finitude.
Things that relate to our finitude, excellent. What else?
Empirical data.
Well, that's a funny word. That sounds too scientific.
In life.
Life.
Sensuousness.
Sensuousness, yeah?
Messy.
Messy. Certainly it's messy stuff, but it doesn't like mess. Philosophy hates mess, especially French philosophy. Ce n'est pas possible. Yeah?
Pleasure.
Pleasure? Sure.
No, two different kinds of pleasure, though. like, you know, stuff.
Aristotle, well, has a notion. No. Ruby's absolutely right. What she is pointing to is philosophers rationalize pleasure into a notion of happiness that is a rational notion of pleasure, and I take it Todd being Todd is thinking of much lower pleasures than that. Really low pleasures.
Like creaturely.
Creaturely. What I want to say, first of all, the most obvious thing about all of these things is that they are the things that give us, they have two characteristics. One is they define our interests in the world. That we are attached to the world and interested in the world because we're interested in our next meal, our next sex, our next drugs, how we're going to survive, our children. I have a lot to say about children. I've just been writing a lot about Abraham and Isaac. Right? Religion also hates children. Right? How does religion begin? Let's sacrifice Isaac. I mean, it begins with the sacrifice of children. Save your soul, forget the kids. I believe that's what religion is, but that's another conversation. What all these things then share are twofold. One is they define us in terms of us as living beings who are interested in the world via the needs we have in order to have a life and how we are going to reproduce that life, where money and work. So where money is, I would have put labor. That's one of the other things that philosophers don't talk about, is laboring. Right? Now, and this now becomes fascinating, because philosophy tears out from human life everything that makes it interesting, and then says, let's let the guy who is not interested in life at all, let's call him the philosopher king, let him rule. And why should we let him rule? Because he has no interests. Because he is not bound by those things, taken this way and that, he is then able to rule wholly in accordance with ideas. So Danto, Arthur Danto in his essay on the philosophical disenfranchisement of art. So a little bit of that argument, that philosophy begins by disenfranchising art, of silencing it, emptying it. Danto says the following. He says, one of the reasons Plato thought that philosophers should be kings was that they, concerned only and ultimately with pure forms, could not coherently have any interests in the world of appearances, hence not be motivated by what normally moves men and women, money, power, sex, love, and so could achieve disinterested decisions. Notice how quickly a little sex and we say, resign from the Senate. Gone. I mean, how fast was that? That's just too interesting, right? Plato cleverly situates works of art outside the range of interests as well, since who could feel exultant at possessing what merely appeared to be gold? And making copies of copies of copies, mere appearances, how could you be interested in anything in art at all? So he empties it of the possibility that we could be interested in it. Since to be human is very largely to have interests, art stands outside the human order pretty much as reality stands outside the primary apparent order in Plato's system. So, though they approach the issue from opposite directions, the implication in both is that art is a kind of ontological vacation place from our defining concerns as human, and with respect to which, accordingly, makes nothing happen. Art makes nothing happen. Now, in putting up this list, what I wanted to suggest to you, at least, is this, that there are two broad topics, namely life and the reproduction of life on the one hand, and on the other hand, art. And philosophy seems to be about the eschewal of both. Let me now remind you that the Critique of Judgment has two parts. A part about art and a part about life. So that somewhere and somehow, in a way that we need to figure out, or we're in the business of figuring out, that philosophy has been trying to figure out since he wrote the Critique of Judgment, we are trying to think about the connection between art and life in the broad sense in which I've talked about it here. But I do want to say, and I want to say it as emphatically as possible, it's not accidental that the Critique of Judgment has two parts and that those two parts are somehow related. That Kant, in a fumbling way, and I think it was fumbling, but in an intuitive way, knew that these phenomena were hooked up with one another, and there are clear reasons how, in his case. And that in thinking about their togetherness, we're also thinking about what philosophy has always left out. And therefore, since I want to say that the Critique of Judgment is an anxious text that is based on the intuition, and I'll say more about this, it's based on this intuition that we can't leave this stuff behind, not completely. We have to engage it, we have to place it. And what makes the Critique of Judgment the text it is, or so I'm going to argue, is that acknowledgement of life and art, whatever that acknowledgement means, is systematically fraught. What I mean by that, when I say that it's systematically fraught, I mean that in ways that I'm going to have to elaborate, that you can read the Critique of Judgment in two absolutely contrary ways. And indeed, you must read it in both these contrary ways. On the one hand, Kant is a Platonist. And his strategy is a strategy of ephemeralization and takeover. So he does a version of the Plato dismissal. On the other hand, there are ways of reading the Critique of Judgment that make the Critique of Judgment a critique of that exclusion, that make the Critique of Judgment exactly about the necessity, unavoidability, and unappropriability, in the Platonic sense, of these phenomena of life and whatever it is that makes art or aesthetics important. To put it another way, the Critique of Judgment, I think of as the pivotal moment in which, as a crossroads, where philosophy decides what it's going to be when it grows up. Right? And one story of what it's going to be when it grows up, the Platonic story, leads directly to analytic philosophy. And the other story, the story that reads the Critique of Judgment as an imminent critique of that form of reductionism, generates all, I would argue, the fundamental gestures of continental philosophy. That it sets the trajectory up. So it's not just that it's there, it's that in engaging with it, you're faced with this terrible decision, this moment of decision, about how to read it in relationship to the rest of Kant, and how important that is, I'll come to. And how you do so will determine literally what road you will take. Ruby?
Is that where the sense a priori argument comes from?
No. I'll get to synthetic a priori later. Okay? For the moment, just try to just think about, as it were, this stuff and the art stuff as what philosophy needs to engage with, or maybe doesn't need to. I mean, you may say, you know, maybe philosophy ought to do something else when it grows up. Maybe, just to make the obvious point, maybe when philosophy grows up, it should be an under-laborer to science. That's what analytic philosophy has been. It takes it for granted, and so did Kant, that the great achievements of modernity are Newtonian and then Einsteinian physics on the one hand, and Darwinian evolutionary biology on the other. And if we're going to understand the world, we just have to kind of figure out what it means to work within those horizons. Right? That's one way of thinking about things. And then there'll be this other way. So, on the one hand, Kant says, just now, let me just say how easily and quickly, just to make it obvious, you can think of Kant as doing an ephemeralization and takeover gesture. Kant says that works of art are purposive, but without an external purpose. That is, they have an internal complexion, they're internal, ordered in a certain way, but they're not for anything. They don't tell you what to do. They don't give you any knowledge. They're perfectly useless. That's hardly a way of applauding art. Furthermore, that is, they have nothing, you know, in that sense, they're empty of truth and morality. Secondly, Kant says that art, and this is Ruby's argument, gives us disinterested pleasure.
My argument?
Yeah, when you said that there are two kinds of pleasure. So one kind of pleasure is low-down Kesselman pleasure, and the other is high-up Bloom pleasure. Okay?
I'm not Aristotle's contemplative
okay.
role.
Okay. I'm just playing.
So,
Danto construes disinterested pleasure, fascinatingly, by saying it offers tepid gratification. And even better, he calls it narcoleptic pleasure. He is great. Narcoleptic pleasure. So one side, that would be the ephemeralization takeover strategy in Kant, which he's there and then going to say that the work of art is a symbol of the morally good. Perfect takeover. Conversely, for a whole lots of philosophers, the idea of aesthetic pleasure and the engagement with purposive wholes yields a wholly different way of thinking about philosophy. For Schelling and for Nietzsche, it points to the problem of life and the centrality of life. For Hegel, it opens up the question of history. For Heidegger, Merleau-Ponty, Lyotard, and Deleuze, they find in the aesthetic suppressed forms of modes of interaction with the world. That is, there are ways of engaging with objects that are not scientific modes or rational modes, right? And that's what the reflective judgment stuff is going to be about next time we meet. So Kant can be read as truly hyper-conservative or as an unwilling radical. It's not an accident, right, that Lyotard, no crazier neo-Trotskyist do we have, right? You know, I love him for that. But he's a Kantian. He defines himself in terms of a third critique Kantian. That is, there are whole ways of doing philosophy that define themselves as coming right out of the third critique, right, and approaching everything from its vantage point. And to read Kant in this way is to read the Critique of Judgment not as a supplement to the first two critiques, but as implying an implicit criticism of them. That is, so one story says that the third critique completes Kant's system, fills it out, brings in all the missing pieces, and harmonizes everything. The other reading says the third critique explodes the first two critiques and leaves them in tatters. Even more bizarrely than what you find in Lyotard and in continental philosophy are the appropriations of art and the aesthetic by Marxists. By Marxists. Marx himself, Lukács, Adorno, Benjamin, and, you know, then Terry Eagleton or Frederick Jameson. I mean, this is truly bizarre and perverse, right? I mean, here's the moment. It's 1930. The revolution in Russia has turned really bad, and the revolution has been defeated all across Europe. The proletariat is in disarray. Fascism is on the rise. And what do we hear a clarion call? Let's think about art! Let's think about art? This is it? This is the response to the failure of the revolution? Marxism, it is sometimes said, lives on as aesthetics. I mean, how weird is that? And then all the discussions of modernism by writers like Greenberg and T.J. Clark, as if modernism alone was the avatar of a future revolution. Okay. That's also my position, sir. But, on the face of it, I want you to feel the absurdity of it. Otherwise, we're not going to feel the stakes of the text. Okay. Now, all these discussions, I'm suggesting, necessarily go through the Critique of Judgment. The Critique of Judgment is really the founding text of modern aesthetics. There is no modern philosophy of art and aesthetics without the Critique of Judgment. It is the text, and everything else, I would argue, is really just a footnote to it. Nothing really, I mean, all sorts of things really supplement and are interesting and fascinating, but they are all variations on Kantian themes. So to understand the stakes here is really to engage with the Critique of Judgment. And the reason for that is because it is where philosophy confronts its own constitutive exclusions. That is, one last time, to either ephemeralize and take over, following Plato, or to ruin philosophy's self-congratulatory self-understanding from within. And it is quite natural that Kant should so be so torn about this, since his philosophy begins with the problem, which I take to be definitive of the modern situation, of the disenchantment of nature. That is the moment of Newtonian physics as harmonizing celestial and terrestrial mechanics and providing a universal account of how everything is related to everything else. This problem of the disenchantment of nature, all the stories about Kant missing his walk when he read Rousseau's Émile, Rousseau's Émile, one of the only two texts on education and children that we have. Actually, the only one on children by philosophers were three. Is there another one on children?
Dewey.
I always forget Dewey. Adorno always says that. The noble John Dewey. But Dewey absolutely cared about it and saw a connection with politics. Pragmatism, of course, comes right out of this tradition as well, comes right out of Hegel. So the human motivation behind Kant's system, the best argument for this is in Richard Veltley's book. What's its title? Anyone? Richard Veltley, terrific book on the origins of Kant's system. As Veltley rightly argues, the motivation behind the entirety of Kant's system was his concern for the meaning of freedom and morality against the background of the undeniable universality and validity of Newtonian science. That is, Kant takes it for granted Newton's got it right. But what Kant was the first philosopher to recognize was that if we simply accept the claims of Newtonian science on face value, then we cannot even make sense of the idea of science, because we cannot think about what it means for something to be true. That is, the one thing that science cannot explain is science. So that science always has this terrible remnant, this remnant of itself as an account of the world. In an entirely perfect Newtonian universe, there would be no room for truth or reason or science. It would all just be determinism all the way down. And some contemporary philosophers bite the bullet on this. They say, yep. And this is the project of what's called epistemology naturalized, or naturalistic epistemology. That is, you try to provide some sort of evolutionary account, right, of the nature of knowledge. The most, for me, heartwarming version of this is Charles Sanders Peirce, who says that nature grows knowers in order to know itself. Well, that's endearing, but silly, right? But I believe that epistemology, naturalistic epistemology, that version is pushed into that form of silliness. That is, I think all the accounts, whether it's Peirce, who is heartwarming, or Quine, who is, you know, dry as dust, they all are versions of Peirce. And Quine's first essay was a review of Peirce's writings. So Epistemology Naturalized tries to give a naturalistic account of science, but it can't do so, right, without, of course, fudging on what's meant by reason or rationality and the like. So forget, in the first instance, you don't even have to worry about freedom and morality. Right? Newtonian theory can't account for Newtonian theory. So when Kant says, in the first critique, that he had to limit knowledge in order to make room for faith, the faith he was concerned with was the faith in freedom and reason, in the first instance, nothing to do with God. He was simply interested in whether we could make sense of ourselves as rational and moral creatures. Hence, the initial gesture of Kant's entire philosophical project is a critique of instrumental reason. That's what Kant was doing, providing a critique of instrumental reasoning, by which I mean, if we define instrumental reasoning as that form of reasoning that is restricted to means-end reasoning. Okay. Kant's saying if that's all there is, then there is no reason at all. All you have are forms of calculation. And interestingly, the issues that are central to the third critique were originally part of Kant's plan for the first critique. Kant wrote to his student, Marcus Hertz, in 1772, that he was preparing a book to be called The Limits of Sensibility and Reason, and that it would consist in two parts. First, a general phenomenology and the nature and method of metaphysics, and second, and the second has two parts, first, the universal principles of feeling, taste, sensuous desire, and second, the first principles of morality. So originally, Kant had intended to write a book that covered everything that's now in the first critique, everything that's now in the second critique, and something that's even wider than what's in the existing third critique, namely the universal principles of feeling, taste, and sensuous desire. I love it that there should be, you know, a set of rules about how to make love. Right? Great. Principles of Lovemaking by Immanuel Kant. my friend Honora O'Neill, who I think is the best writer on Kant's moral philosophy, has a t-shirt that says, "Kantians do it out of duty." All right, here is another way of thinking about Kant's general strategy. Another way is, instead of saying that Kant's offering a critique of instrumental reason, we could say that Kant's strategy is a critique of metaphysics. And it would be equally accurate. And when we think of it that way, we can think that what Kant is up to is providing a modern version of the so-called transcendental ideas of the scholastic tradition. That is, the ideas of truth and goodness and beauty. And these are, for the scholastics, the ultimate categories, which are, of course, unified literally in God. Depends whether you're a Thomist or an anti-Thomist. Anyway, I won't go.
What Kant does is each of his three critiques is going to pick up one of these. So the critique of pure reason is concerned with the questions of knowledge and science. The critique of practical reason is going to be concerned with morality and goodness. And the third critique of judgment, is going to be concerned with beauty. Now, what makes Kant modern in all of this is that, first, there is no unity of the three critiques. They talk to one another, but reason is essentially fragmented and not one. And it cannot be totalized. So the goal of the three critiques is to talk about truth, rightness, and beauty from a wholly human perspective. What I mean by that is the following. Kant did not ask the question, how can human knowing approach divine knowing? How can we know how things are in the world absolutely? He thought that was a bad question. He equally thought that it was a bad question to ask, how can human beings approach saintliness or mimic divine goodness or embody divine commands? He thought we had no knowledge of any divinities or anything outside ourselves that could be called divine commands. Rather, he asked a series of very different questions. He asked the questions, what is it for human beings, that is, beings who are both rational and sensible, to have access to a world existing independently of them, where such access and such knowing makes no reference whatsoever to God's perspective? So when Kant says, we know appearances only and not things in themselves, he is saying that we know things only from our human perspective, and how they appear from a divine perspective, we do not know, and we cannot even speculate about. It is empty and meaningless. And therefore, we will never know how things are in themselves. That is, the way God created the world is a closed book, forever and necessarily. That's why I say this is a critique of metaphysics, because the totality of the world disappears. We cannot know the world as a whole. Because why? Because to know the world as a whole, you would have to have a standpoint outside of it. You know, you can jump and jump, but I can't even get out of the room, no less. You know, so right, if you're going to see it from a human perspective, you are always seeing it from within, and that's definitive and constitutive of human knowing, and not a deficiency. For every other philosopher before Kant, it was a deficiency. It was a privation. Oh, yeah, our senses, they get in the way.
for Kant, it was not a deficiency or privation. It was the meaning of it to see it from a human perspective. There was a question.
Whether we can count Leibniz as a modern philosopher, because he says that we cannot know the defined necessity, right?
Yeah, but he thinks that that's the true perspective. He thinks if we did know it, then we'd know how things are in themselves. Therefore, he's still thinking that is a failure that we don't know it. So there are lots of philosophers who don't think we can know it. Hume thinks, obviously thinks, we can't know how things are in themselves, but he thinks that's what it would be to really know things. So he thinks we have second best knowledge. For Kant, there's nothing... Disagree about you? Okay. We can argue about that at the break. For Kant, though, absolutely the case that this is not a failure of any kind. It is the fact that we're limited is constitutive. So the limits of reason, this is the Kantian gesture, right? The limits of reason are equally the conditions of possibility. That's the Kantian mantra. You want a mantra for the night? The limits of possibility, what limits you is not an absolute limitation. It's a condition of possibility, right? And rather than, therefore, working against those limits, Kant tries to expose them as the very meaning of what it is to know it all. Analogously, with the question of morality, Kant says, what it is for you, what is it for human beings to act well? What then is the meaning of acting and doing for beings who can reflectively determine their own conduct? Right? So he imagines, right at the very beginning of the groundwork, he says, what would happen if Jesus Christ came down and said, hey, I'm here, and let me tell you what to do? And Kant says, what we would have to do is say, all right, well, tell us what to do. And he'd say, oh, well, shoot everyone in sight, right? I guess. And Kant's question is only this. He says, no matter what he says, we would ask, does it correspond to the categorical imperative? That is, the intelligibility of Christ would only be whether or not his actions corresponded to our ideas. Right? To give up that standpoint, the categorical imperative is Kant's notion of morality, I'll explain that later, but this notion of the moral law, that constitutes what right acting is, and it's internal to our reason, and nothing else has authority for us. There is no authority except the authority of finite reason. So maybe there's something called saintliness, but we will never know. So what Kant does, this is why I called it a critique of metaphysics, is he thinks those old questions, what is truth or goodness really, are ill-formed. And they're ill-formed because they are the denial of the human perspective. And the human perspective is constitutive of the possibility of knowing an action. To state that Kant's position this way is to say that it is defined by a general strategy that can be called the Copernican turn. And the other thing about the human perspective, I don't know about yours, but mine is sweating like hell. So I think this human finitude requires some fresh air. So let us use this moment before the party can turn to get some fresh air and open the doors and stuff like that. And we'll pick up there.